thanks to the organizers for inviting me. I'm quite happy to be back at BI, I think after 2 years. So today I'm going to tell you a little bit about some work that I did with Vicky, Victoria Wright, actually when she was visiting PI long ago. That's when it started, but we only finished it more recently. So this work is essentially about the role of entanglement in if you want to establish proofs of contextuality for multi-qubit systems. Okay, and then maybe I'll say a little bit about magic since everyone here is presumably interested in models of quantum computation. So hopefully I'll have something to say about it at the end. Not a lot. So I'll actually start with like two announcements. It's one of those French words I like because you know the English equivalent is longer. So the first thing is that I just recently moved to Marseille and I'm trying to set up a group there. And if you're interested in positions, master's internships, postdocs, maybe PhD projects, please reach out to me. I'm based at this team, Calcul Natural, Natural Computation Group. There's two of us there working on quantum stuff. So there's Giuseppe De Molfetta who works on quantum walks and cellular automata in general. I work mostly on quantum foundations, quantum information. And yeah, I should also thank the AMIDEX Foundation that funds my research there. So yeah, I mean, like, you know, this is 45 minutes from your office if you visit us. So yeah, it's a good place to work. Okay, the second announcement is that we're gonna organize this, the second edition of this conference, Foundations of Quantum Computing, in the UK at Royal Holloway. So it's mainly organized by Farid Chahande at Royal Holloway. I'm helping him out, and together with me, there's Matty Hoban from Oxford. So we're trying to put together a program for this conference, and I encourage you to look up the website as it's updated. And yeah, so it's at the beginning of September. Last year we had a fun conference, the first edition of the conference. You can see some of the people here were there as well. So you have Robert, Michael should be there somewhere. Anyway, yeah, so, and you know, we also played foosball and you know, it was generalized contextuality versus Cauchy-Speckert contextuality and it's clear which one won, right? So, and this is actually stolen from Robert's slide because this is essentially what the sort of conference is usually about. It's about like foundational questions about quantum computing. And so please join us this year, 3rd to 5th September, if you're interested in these questions. Okay, now I can move on to my talk. So, you know, in keeping with the tradition of introducing triangles and like, you know, trying to understand the relationship between three things, I made this triangle of contextuality, entanglement, and magic, specifically with reference to multi-qubit systems, so that is important. So in some senses, this talk maybe complements David's talk because this is about multi-qubit systems rather than odd-dimensional systems. And I largely focus on contextuality vis-a-vis entanglement with a little bit to say something about magic at the end. So when I say contextuality versus entanglement, I essentially mean the way I'm kind of conceptually parsing these two notions is as notions of non-classicality that are applicable to composite systems. So, you know, you have entanglement, you have Bell's theorem, which requires entanglement. On the other hand, you have notions of non-classicality that you can articulate for systems of prime dimensions, for example, dimension 3, so indivisible systems in general. So that's something called Gleason's theorem, and there is contextuality in the sense of the Cauchy-Speckert theorem, just to make a lot of people here, including Robert and Samson, very happy. So I'm not gonna talk about generalized contextuality at all in this talk. I'm gonna focus on Cauchy-Speckert contextuality. And I'm gonna look at the interaction between these notions for the case of multi-qubit systems. And I'm gonna end with the question of when is entanglement magical and why that question naturally arises when I think about these foundational questions. Okay, so the first half of the talk is largely just like introducing the definitions, the concepts, and then I'll put these together and state some of the results. I will obviously not try to sketch any proofs, but yeah, we can chat about it in the Q&A if you like. So of course, entanglement, I guess I don't have to introduce what an entangled state is, but I do need to make precise what I mean by an entangled measurement. So whenever I say an entangled measurement in the stock, I will mean that, so I'm thinking of projective measurements. And when I say entangled measurement, I just mean that at least one of the eigenstates is entangled. So there's some entangled projection involved in the measurement. And when I say unentangled measurement, I mean a measurement, of course, where none of the eigenstates is entangled, right? So you can have LOCC type measurements. So in particular, you can have product measurements, local, where Alice and Bob, they're doing just some independent measurements. So here Alice is doing the Z measurement, Bob is doing the X measurement. And you know, so these are the kinds of measurements you do in a Bell scenario, local operations, LO. You can have adaptive operations, adaptive measurements, which are LOCC, where you know Alice maybe measures in the Z basis, observes an outcome, sends it to Bob. If the outcome is zero, Bob measures in the Z basis. If it's one, then Bob measures in the X basis. Okay, so this is an adaptive kind of measurement. This is not the kind of measurement you do in a Bell experiment, for example. There's non-LOCC measurements that are unentangled, but they're nevertheless, you cannot do them using LOCC operations. So by LOCC, of course, I mean local operations in classical communication, and this is an example of that. So this is called the shift measurement, shift basis. So this appears, for example, in phenomena called quantum non-locality without entanglement, if you've heard of those. So I will not go into what that is, but the point is that these kinds of measurements, these are global measurements that don't require entanglement, okay? Just to keep it in mind, because later on this will be important. Okay, Bell's theorem, the second sort of composite notion I was talking about. I obviously am not going to introduce it, but I'm just going to simply say that it's whenever you have product measurements on an entangled state that violate certain constraints called Bell inequalities, you have a proof of Bell's theorem, right? So you're essentially showing that you can achieve some correlations that cannot be achieved by classical shared randomness between the parties. So it's also a certificate of entanglement in that sense. Okay, now we come to the notions that are applicable also to indivisible systems. So the first is Gleason's theorem. Just by show of hands, how many people know what Gleason's theorem is? Okay, So I'll still kind of give you a little bit of a flavor of what the theorem says. So this is essentially what the theorem proves. It says that if you give me the structure of measurements in quantum theory, specifically projective measurements in quantum theory, in dimension 3 or higher, then that structure is enough to fix the structure of states in quantum theory. So essentially it recovers the bond rule given the structure of measurements in quantum theory. Okay, the formal statement is essentially just this, that if you have a separable Hilbert space of dimension at least 3, and if you try to write down a map from projections to probabilities, which satisfies this additivity property for mutually orthogonal projections, and it assigns value 1 to identity. So under this assumption, then it admits an expression of this form. So this is the sense in which it gives you the structure of states where rho is a density operator on H. Okay? So just to kind of fill out that conceptual scheme that I just laid out. Okay? It's not going to be completely very crucial, but it's just good to keep it at the back of your mind. Yeah? Say that again? It goes through for dimension at least 3, so including infinite dimensions. I think the original proof was, Gleason's proof was including infinite dimensions, yes. Okay, so the second indivisible notion applicable to indivisible systems is quotient spectral theorem. And here it has a similar flavor as Gleason, except it proves something weaker than Gleason. It says that if I give you the structure of measurements in quantum theory, projective measurements in quantum theory, then it puts a constraint on the structure of states. It doesn't give you the structure of states. It doesn't give you what the full state space is, but it tells you what it cannot be. Okay, so it's a no-go theorem in that sense. And the formal statement, just in analogy with Gleason, is of this form where, you know, again, you have a separable Hilbert space of dimension at least 3, and then the statement is that there does not exist a map, a valuation, a map from projections to deterministic outcomes, so deterministic probabilities, 0, 1 valued probabilities, that satisfies this additivity property together with the requirement that you assign value 1 to the identity, right? So earlier we had the statement that there exists a map from projections to probabilities, which takes the form of like the quantum state essentially. Now we have the statement that, of course, like more physically speaking, this is just saying that there's no state in quantum theory that assigns deterministic outcomes to all measurements, right? That's what you're saying. Okay. So if you look at the way I stated the theorems, it's clear that Gleason implies quotient Speckr. So if I give you a proof of Gleason's theorem, that implies that you also have a, strictly speaking, you've shown the non-existence of that map C, once you've shown that what the structure of states is, right? So why do we care about quotient Speckr? We care about it because we can prove it using only a finite set of projections. Okay, so you need a very small, unlike Gleason, where you need the full projection lattice to prove the theorem, here you can prove this no-go theorem using just a finite set of projections. So conceptually, it's also interesting for that reason. So there's two ways I'm classifying proofs of the quotient Speckr theorem here. The first is what I'll call logical proofs. So these are the ones that proceed from a straightforward logical contradiction given the structure of the measurements, given their orthogonal relations. So structure of measurements is enough in that sense. You never need to look at their statistics on some state. On the other hand, there are also proofs which are statistical in the sense that they proceed from statistical violations of some inequalities relative to some specially prepared state. You need to prepare special states to observe these proofs. So they require the structure of states in that sense. So these are kind of like qualitatively the same as like, you know, Bell's violations of Bell inequalities and stuff like that. So that's a category of statistical proofs. Okay, so when I say logical proof, here's the smallest known example. And it's a four-dimensional system. You have these vertices are just projections, rank one projections. And the loops, the hyper edges, are orthonormal bases. And whenever a vertex is shared between two orthonormal bases, it's you require that the map, if you assume the existence of the map C that assigns them outcomes, ones and zero, to each of these vertices, then it becomes a coloring problem. And essentially, the quotient Speckr theorem is the statement that you cannot color this in a way that respects the conditions we required of that map C. Okay? So intuitively, this is the idea that if you look at this, the number of edges, hyper edges here, there are 9 hyper edges, so 6 along the corners and then 3 along these diagonals. And so there are 9 sort of measurements, each of which has to have exactly one outcome. However, each outcome is shared across 2 measurement contexts. So you have to, on the one hand, you have to have an odd number of ones. On the other hand, you have to have an even number of ones. So that can never happen. And so therefore, you have a proof of the quotient Speckr theorem. Okay? So just a very rushed sort of introduction to what this is. Here's an example of a statistical proof in 3 dimensions, where, again, you assume the existence of a map C. You ask, okay, what are the deterministic assignments I can make to these guys? And then you allow for probabilistic mixtures over those deterministic assignments. And then the statement is that the probabilities assigned to, for example, these vertices in this structure, measurement structure, they will not add up to something greater than 2. And in quantum theory, you can construct states and measurements which violate this up to square root of 5. So you have a proof of the quotient Speckr theorem in the sense that you've ruled out the existence of that map C by violating this statistical constraint relative to some specially prepared state. Okay? So, and the third one, this is the famous example that I guess most people first encounter when they think of the quotient Speckr theorem, which is the Perez Moment square. And it's in D equals 4. So actually, Perez Moment is sort of implicitly contained in this structure. I just need to add 6 more vertices to this, and you get Perez's 24 vectors. And under appropriate coarse gratings, they form the rows and columns of the Perez Moment square. Okay, so the first example of logical proofs I showed in this one are they're related to each other. However, this is a particularly neat demonstration because you just need to look at these two-qubit observables, and the requirement is that the valuations the values you assign to them are either plus or minus 1, so the eigenvalues of the operators. And the functional relationships are respected. So if the product of these guys is the identity, then the values assigned to these guys, the product of values should be the value assigned to the identity, which is 1. And you can see that it's the same sort of flavor of contradiction where, the left-hand side, you have every term appears twice in 2 of the equations. So if you multiply all of them, you get plus 1 on the left-hand side, minus 1 on the right-hand side. So there is no sort of deterministic assignment, no valuation, no map C that I was talking about, right? Of course, you need to do a bit more work because C was valued 0, 1, and then you have to add assumptions about how you represent operators, which are combinations of projections. Okay, so one thing to observe about the Perez Moment square is that it requires entanglement, right? So if you look at the third column, it requires you to measure in an entangled basis if you want to measure XX, YY, and ZZ together, right? So that's the diagonalizing basis for that. So that is just making that observation, because essentially, like, this project was kind of motivated by just this. Okay, so now we come to the results. The first statement is that any logical proof of the Cauchy-Speicher theorem on a multi-qubit system necessarily requires entangled measurements. So if you want to build a contradiction of that type, where you have this hypergraph that is not colorable in the Cauchy-Speicher sense, then the vertices must be, at least some of the vertices must be associated with entangled projections. Okay, they cannot all be unentangled. And this is at first sight, you might just think of Bell and, let me just actually go through this first. So if you look at non-LOCC unentangled measurements, so these are like global measurements that go beyond what you can do in a Bell experiment or even in an adaptive situation, LOCC measurements, you might imagine that having those additional orthogonality relations that come from those non-LOCC measurements maybe offer the possibility of a logical contradiction. However, this theorem essentially shows that they do not offer any advantage over local LO or LOCC measurements for these Cauchy-Speicher type contradictions. Okay, and the second observation is obviously that the presence of entanglement in a pairs moment type construction for a multi-qubit system is not accidental. It's like for any multi-qubit system, when you try to construct a Cauchy-Speicher type argument in this vein, you will require some entangled measurements. Okay, so that's the first statement. The second statement is about statistical proofs of the Cauchy-Speicher theorem. This is maybe a bit more obvious if you know about the single qubit Cauchy-Speicher model for projective measurements, because this is just an extension of that. So any statistical proof of the Cauchy-Speicher theorem on a multi-qubit system with unentangled measurements, which includes the non-LOCC measurements I talked about, it necessarily requires an entangled state. Okay. Then, of course, the natural question is are entangled states sufficient for such a proof? Is it always the case that entangled states can, using maybe non-LOCC measurements, maybe they're useful for statistical proof of the Cauchy-Speicher theorem all the time? And of course, that's not true. The reason that's not true, the formal reason, is because a multi-qubit entangled state will give you a statistical proof of the Cauchy-Speicher theorem. Remember, in the statistical proof, you can have measurements which are not LO, right? So it's a richer set of measurements, if and only if it violates a Bell inequality. And in a Bell violation, you're only allowed local measurements, okay? So in that sense, since we know there exist mixed entangled states that don't violate Bell inequalities, here I just need the statement for projective measurements. In that sense, entanglement is not sufficient for a statistical proof of the Cauchy-Speicher theorem, okay? Okay, and the final set of conceptual results here are about like the connection between Gleason versus Cauchy-Speicher theorem for multi-qubit systems, where D can be all qubits, some qubits, and some higher dimensional systems, or all higher dimensional systems. So here it says unentangled, so I'm looking at situations. When I say unentangled Gleason theorem, I essentially mean that the domain of that map is not the full lattice of projections, but only those which are unentangled projections. So the question is, can you, just using unentangled projections, force the quantum probability rule, force the probability rule to be the bond rule? Okay, now this is true if all systems are at least dimension 3. This is kind of follows straightforwardly from the fact that Cauchy-Speicher theorem holds for a single qutrit, so it holds for unentangled measurements on sort of 3 n qutrits or higher dimensional systems. And if you have some qubits, maybe at least one qubit, and the rest of the systems are qutrits or higher dimensional systems, then you cannot prove Gleason with unentangled measurements. Okay. However, you can still prove Cauchy-Speicher, because some of those are three-dimensional or higher, so you can prove Cauchy-Speicher and you can combine those to have a contradiction for the full system. On the other hand, it's also an implication of a result that since you cannot have a proof of the Cauchy-Speicher theorem using unentangled projections, you cannot have a proof of Gleason's theorem using unentangled projections, right? So this is just an implication that follows from there. This result was already known, like in the early 2000s. I think it was Wallach who showed this, that you cannot prove Gleason's with unentangled projections. Okay, so this brings me sort of like, this was a sort of a quick tour through the results we have on the question of contextuality vis-a-vis entanglement. And now maybe I try to explain why I mentioned magic in my title and why I think that's sort of connected or interesting to think about. Okay. So this was just foundational results, and I'm now trying to see where they connect with maybe quantum computing. Okay. So as David mentioned in the previous talk, this model of quantum computation with state injection, in my mind, this is due to Vicky. Like, she imagined as literally like injecting magic states into the circuit. So yeah, this is my toy picture of what's going on. it looks easy. So you have this free sub-theory of quantum mechanics called stabilizer quantum theory. It's non-universal. You can't do all possible quantum computations with it. But if you supply these so-called magic states, you lift the circuit to universality. You can do universal quantum computation, right? So this model is due to Bravi and Kataev. And the key question here, at least the sense in which contextuality becomes relevant, is which properties pick out these magic states, which states are magic, which ones are not, which ones actually useful for lifting this non-universal gate set to universality. Okay, so of course, the one of the first breakthroughs in this direction was this result for odd prime dimensional qubits, where essentially, you show that magic states must show state-dependent statistical proofs of contextuality relative to measurements in the scheme, Pauli measurements. Yeah, so that was here. Now this argument doesn't go through for qubits, because as I think was alluded to in the previous talk, there are these proofs of contextuality for multi-qubit systems like the Peres moment proof I showed you, right? So of course, and that's a state-independent proof. So which means that given measurements in the stabilizer sub-theory, you already have a proof of contextuality that holds for any input states you might want to throw at it. So there's nothing special about contextuality that picks out like a particular class of states, because all states are contextual with respect to this. So that's the conceptual problem there, right? So then Robert Chihan here, and I guess those are the two co-authors who are here. In this paper, they sort of fix the problem for qubits to show in what sense contextuality is a resource for quantum state injection model with qubits. And the way they do this is by restricting the free set, the free things you can do, right? So restricting this stabilizer, this quantum theory a little bit further, okay? So it requires this, what they call the resource character restriction. I will come to what that means. So this was our model. What they do is they introduce this restriction on resource character, which is that there exists a quantum state without contextuality with respect to available measurements in the scheme. So it's kind of by fiat sort of rules out the possibility of state-independent contextuality, because there's at least one state that is non-contextual with respect to measurements in the scheme, which will not lead to statistical proofs of the Cauchy-Speckle theorem, right? So that's sort of restriction. And in practice, if you look at the concrete model that's proposed, it's of this form where you introduce the restrictions essentially imply that you can only do single qubit measurements. And you can infer these guys, the yellow guys. So these are the inferable observables, which you can compute from the single qubit ones that you do. And then there's the non-inferable stuff that would normally require measurements in an entangled basis and stuff. So you cannot sort of, these are the stuff things you directly measure, things you can infer, and things that are not in your measurement scheme in some sense. Yeah. So what this amounts to effectively in this sense is that there are no entangled measurements in the proposed scheme, which is what kind of sort of avoids the possibility of a Peres moment type contradiction. Now, if you go back to our theorem, which is that a sufficient condition for satisfying this resource character property is to just only propose schemes where, regardless of whatever measurements your circuit does, it never is able to implement an entangled measurement. Okay, it can implement maybe global measurements like separable things that are not LOCC, but it cannot do entangled measurements. Okay. So if you have that property, then you know that you will never have a proof of the Cauchy-Speckle theorem. So you will not have this problem of state-independent contextuality. So that's the connection, basically, because the result we have from just a priori, just completely foundational concerns, it implies that one way to satisfy this resource character condition is this. And in fact, the concrete model proposed actually does exactly that. And so what this means is that all the entanglement in the scheme comes from the magic states, right? So now you don't have product magic states, but in fact you have entangled magic states because, you are going to need some source of entanglement in general. So all the entanglement comes from the magic states, and then this raises the question of, you know, which do arbitrary entangled states work? What kinds of entangled states are useful for a state injection scheme? And so that's the kind of question I want to end on. So I was looking at the literature on what people have studied lately, and I found this paper by Liu and Winter on many-body quantum magic, where they study essentially multi-qubit systems and magic measures on them, and they kind of sort of, it's sort of a deflationary kind of paper. It's not sort of, it doesn't really identify give positive results, but it gives more kind of like, you know, limitations of magic from entangled states. But here, one caveat is that when they say magic, they really mean non-stabilizerness, but I mean something more. I mean that, you know, you can actually lift the circuit to universality, ideally also efficiently distill states using the operations in the circuit. So one thing we know is that, okay, these magic states, whatever you throw at the circuit, should obviously violate Bell inequalities, because that's required for state-dependent kind of proofs of Quotient-Specker. Are there other necessary slash sufficient conditions that characterize these states that are useful for these restricted state injection schemes? So that's why I'm kind of talking about them. So for me, from a foundational perspective, these restricted QCSI models are a potentially fruitful sort of avenue. So even if, like, you know, you, no one's going to do them in the lab, like maybe not, you're still going to sort of understand something about the role of entanglement vis-a-vis magic as it relates to contextuality for universal quantum computation. Of course, like, a lot of the questions about, like, resources for quantum computing are model dependent. They depend on the way you slice up different resources. So here there's like a clean kind of separation. So it's maybe a good avenue for thinking about these things. And if I'm not wrong, like yesterday I was asking Robert if there were any follow-ups to this 2017 kind of examples of restricted models, and I'm not sure it's been studied much. So I just invite you to maybe look at it and think about it, and yeah. I'm going to conclude with a quick takeaway. So these are known connections, right? Like Gleason's theorem, it requires entanglement for multi-qubit systems. Bell's theorem, of course, implies entanglement. This is true in general. Gleason's theorem implies Quotient-Specker theorem. This is true in general. What we proved was in this direction, that if you have Quotient-Specker theorem for multi-qubits, you need entanglement for logical proofs in the measurements, for statistical proofs in the states. And that, you know, Bell's theorem with local measurements is only possible if and only if you have Quotient-Specker theorem with potentially non-LOCC measurements. So now you just take the contrapositives, and then we have the things I was saying, which is that if you don't have any entanglement, then you cannot have a proof of the Quotient-Specker theorem. And this kind of explains, in some sense, quote-unquote, explains restrictions in multi-qubit state injection schemes. And on the other hand, like this equivalence tells us that essentially magic states in these restricted schemes must violate Bell inequalities under local measurements. Yeah, and so I'll end with this question of when is entanglement magical, and how much magic do you actually need in an entangled state, by what measures, and so for that I think this paper is a good study of measures and things. So if you're interested in measures for magic for entangled states, okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ravi. Nice talk. Do we have questions from the audience? Yes.
Have you investigated what happens in the case of measurement-based quantum computation?
Yeah, so I think the way this was, so I didn't directly, but the way this restricted QCSI scheme was proposed, it was kind of a modified MBQC, if I'm not wrong, right? Like it was. Yeah. So essentially, like you modified a cluster state to make it non-stabilizer, and then it was enough for the scheme. So maybe for the connection, like the closest connection I've seen is at the end of that 2017 paper, where you can see it explicitly mentioned. But I don't have more to say about it. Yeah.
Thank you.
I have a question about the statistical, the KCBS kind of pentagram.
Yes. Yeah.
So I guess one question I have is, so in the other ones, like the Koshin Specker and the Merman Prez Magic Square, you kind of have this, there's this, like one of them is state independent, and then, but this one's state dependent, right? Like there's can write down a state on like, so I guess here, do you have some sort of like, so this is like this is demonstrating non-contextuality.
It's demonstrating the non-existence of that map C that I was talking about from projections to outcomes.
Yeah, right, but it doesn't, so my question is, you don't know you don't need entanglement here, right? Can you say anything more about that?
Yeah. So this is actually another kind of open avenue of research, which I've been thinking a little bit about, but I haven't spent enough time on it, which is that, so for multi-qubit systems, we saw that, like, you know, logical contradiction in the sense of Koshin Specker requires entanglement in the measurements. So what's the analog of this for indivisible systems, for example? And there are certain proposals in the literature for, you know, a subsystem independent notion of entanglement. Like, so I think there's in the early 2000s, Howard Barnum and like some collaborators had these papers on generalizing entanglement, like in terms of like subalgebras and things, rather than sort of taking an observable kind of base perspective. And so I would say that if you were to try to generalize this observation, you have to go to some generalized notion of entanglement that sort of is applicable to indivisible systems, and then you ask, is there a sense in which and actually, okay, so the reason I'm saying this is because if you look on the archive, there are some old papers by Kliashko, where actually the way he came up with KCBS was by thinking about generalized entanglement in a sense.
Yeah.
So that's the closest connection I can think of.
Yeah, I guess, because in the other case, in like the correlation is kind of really interesting because it's like unique up to isometries. Like it's not only it's what's called a self-test, right? But I guess I'm curious, like if anything is known like that about this kind of the correlations that arise from this scenario.
So there are some. I haven't, like myself, read the papers very carefully, but there are some claims about doing self-testing with KCBS in the literature.
So okay, cool.
If you Google, you'll find it, I think.
Okay, thanks.
Papers. Yeah. But of course, they require more assumptions than Bell because, you know, they need to assume sharpness of the measurements and things like that, which are kind of conceptual issues which make Koshin Specker different from Bell. So self-testing, like, is with a lot of caveats, basically, for these kinds of scenarios.
More questions? Do we have questions from the online audience?
Hi.
Yes,
can
go
I,
for it. Oui.
Can I ask a quick question? Oh. Hi, Ravi. Thanks for your talk. I think it must have been something that I missed in your earlier on. But so when you say that Gleason's theorem implies Koshin Specker theorem, so like what is the precise statement that you mean? Other than, I mean, of course, any true statement implies another true statement, so it must be. You mean something more precise there?
So, sorry, can you repeat? Like, so is it not
yeah,
clear?
Yeah. So, what is the precise? Well, I mean, it is obvious that both of them are closed theorems, so they're true statements. So obviously they imply each other. But you mean something more specific? I just wanted to know exactly.
So I think the specific. So maybe I just state what I mean, and then you can tell me if that doesn't satisfy you.
Yeah.
Okay. So the thing I meant was. So this was the formal statement of Gleason, right? That if you're looking for a map from projections to probabilities that satisfies these constraints, then that map must take the form of a density matrix, right? Like under this trace rule. So that's Gleason's theorem. And if you have, if you've shown that the unique way to assign probabilities to projections is via quantum states, then we know that, you know, so you've already kind of using the antecedent here, you're using the same antecedent in both situations. You've already shown what the structure of states is, and you know that these states, given the structure of states, you know that, none of these states are deterministic on all possible measurements, right? So in that sense, you know that there doesn't exist this sort of map which assigns deterministic outcomes to all measurements, subject to these constraints. And so that's the sense in which Gleason implies Koshin Specker. Does that help?
Yes, I think that was clear. Yes, yes. Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
And are there other questions from the online audience? We have one from Yes, Nadish, I'll throw this.
Can you look at the Kolkensperger like pentagram?
Yeah.
So you said this implies the non-existence of a map C?
Yeah.
But if it's statistical, can there exist these functions C and there's no distribution that... what are the actions of the sets of the C function? Is that not one?
So yes, yeah, this is a one possible coloring, like one possible C sort of function.
Yeah.
What I've drawn here, like the orange things are probably one and the black things are probably zero. So yes, this is one possible assignment.
Yeah.
And you look at the set of all possible such assignments.
Yeah.
Like all possible map C essentially, like that describes essentially the vertices of the classical polytope that you might define in this case.
Yeah.
Right? And so that puts a bound on this the sum of these five probabilities to be less than or equal to 2 because none of these vertices achieve more than 2.
Yeah.
Right? And then you identify a quantum state and projections with these orthogonality relations for which you exceed this bound. So there's no conceivable way that you could have reproduced that statistics where you go to square root of 5 using a convex combination of maps of the C type, the C map.
So there do exist functions C, they're just not...
Yeah, they're just not enough to explain the quantum statistics, which is like which goes up to square root of 5. Like, so right. The moment you exceed 2, you've ruled out that it could have been reproduced by like maps
I think
of the...
Because I think you said that there is no function C. The Kolkensperger theorem says
that... That does... So in this... Okay, I should say it more carefully, which is that there exists no function C that does justice to the experimental statistics relative to at least one quantum state in this case, right? Like, in the other case, I didn't have to refer to a quantum state. Here, there will obviously be quantum states where you can describe everything with these maps C, the probabilities.
So the difference between the logical proof and the statistical proofs is not the logical proof. There is no... There proves that there is no C.
Yeah.
In the statistical proof, there can exist C, but there's not a distribution over them that can reach the quantum bound.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the more precise way to put it, but yeah. Cool.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, I have one. Since you graciously did a very short talk, so we have more discussion. Right?
Oh, great.
No, that's good. My question is, when you prove that you need entanglements for the logical contradictions, are you restricting yourself to stabilize a subtheory, or are you talking in general?
Yeah. Actually, like it might be interesting to study like more specialized instances of these theorems for the case of the stabilizer subtheory, and but of course, like there you know that in odd prime dimensions you don't have proofs of Kolkensperger theorem, right? So there are questions, for example, okay, you need entanglement to have these contradictions, but how much entanglement? What kind of entanglement? Like, should the measurements be fully entangled because, like, the Bell basis or something? Or could they be just, like, you know, some entangled vectors, some product vectors, and that could work? So we have some counterexamples to some of these in our paper, but we didn't kind of fully settle the question of... So, for example, you don't need fully entangled bases. We know that you don't need fully entangled bases. You can do it with some product and some entangled things. So we construct examples like that. So you can ask more specialized questions like within this general kind of general results we've established, and especially if you're trying to be relevant to the state injection schemes, then I guess you want to actually ask more specialized questions, because there really everything I said was relative to not just measurements in the scheme but in general. When I said like Bell inequality violations, I didn't say Bell inequality violation relative to measurements in the scheme, I said in general, right? So I didn't give a more precise answer. Maybe there's a more precise answer to give there. So yeah. So that's open, yeah.
Thanks. Any other questions, maybe from online as well? Here, local? If not, let's thank Ravi again. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.